Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, Tradewinds, the export business in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. So the export business, it sounds pretty exotic, right? Flying off to far-flung places, haggling over coffee in Casablanca or beers in Bavaria. It's also a vague and ambiguous description for a collection of business activities cutting across industries and boundaries. Now, there are a couple of famous fictional exporters highlighting just how fuzzy and foreign the exporting business may be.
James Bond, Universal Exports.
Art Vandelay.
Art Vandelay? This is my boyfriend?
That's your boyfriend.
What does he do?
He's an importer.
Just imports, no exports?
He's an importer-exporter, okay?
Seinfeld's George Costanza's make-believe friend and alter ego, Art Vandelay, and of course, James Bond. Bond's cover story has been that of an exporter traveling the world since Dr. No in 1962. Now, few people in the real exporting business call themselves exporters. Instead, they make lights for yachts, or shaving cream and cologne, or sutures used by surgeons. Exporting is something they do with their products. It's how they find buyers in Bogota or Beijing. It's an opportunity to spread American-made goods and services across the globe.
We need to export more of our goods.
This is President Obama at his first official State of the Union address in January 2010.
Because the more products we make and sell to other countries, the more jobs we support right here in America. So tonight, we set a new goal. We will double our exports over the next 5 years, an increase that will support 2 million jobs in America.
At the time, American exports totaled $1.9 trillion. In order to meet the president's goal of doubling that number in 5 years, the U.S. would have to sell $3.8 trillion worth of goods and services to foreign buyers by 2015.
To help meet this goal, we're launching a national export initiative that will help farmers and small businesses increase their exports and reform export controls consistent with national security.
So here's the scoreboard now. 3 years into the president's challenge, U.S. exports, $2.3 trillion. That's only 20% toward the goal, and with only 2 years left.
We have to seek new markets aggressively, just as our competitors are. If America sits on the sidelines while other nations sign trade deals, we will lose the chance to create jobs on our shores.
A year and a half after making this pledge, Congress approved and the president signed 3 new free trade agreements, one each with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. The trade pacts were the result of a strange mix of political partners. Most Democrats on Capitol Hill did not vote for the deals, despite President Obama's support. Instead, the president, a Democrat, found the votes for these trade deals among congressional Republicans to forge the global agreements. Now, fast forward 3 years, and there's a debate raging in the Republican Party over whether to kill a bank that props up billions of dollars worth of exports, including many from South Florida. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington on how South Florida lawmakers are fighting for the Export-Import Bank's survival in the face of fierce opposition.
Since 2007, the Export-Import Bank of the United States helped 867 Florida businesses export $8 billion worth of goods, according to government records. It's the official export bank of the U.S., providing loan guarantees and other assistance to U.S. companies who export abroad. Like most Democrats, South Florida Congressman Joe Garcia sings the bank's praises.
All that this bank does is help finance our sales abroad. It's an incredible instrument for our manufacturers, particularly manufacturing jobs, which are growing.
Florida is a big foreign export state, with most of the state's goods supported through the bank going to Mexico, Saudi Arabia, and the Dominican Republic. That's why many small businesses consider the bank vital to their ability to compete abroad. Still, many conservatives have gotten behind Texas Congressman Jeb Hensarling's effort to kill the bank. He's rumored to be a popular Republican replacement if House Speaker John Boehner steps down. Hensarling and others argue the bank amounts to corporate welfare.
Too many Americans now believe that the system in America is rigged, that it's unfair, that free enterprise really doesn't work or can't work for them.
South Florida Republicans disagree. Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Leighton says charges of corporate welfare from the man who may be the next Speaker of the House are misguided.
The reality is that we have to compete against other companies for a lot of jobs, and the companies abroad are supported by their governments. So it's really just them standing alone there.
In the last 7 years, the Export-Import Bank helped more than 650 Florida small businesses. 166 of them are minority-owned. Ross Leighton says the bank is especially vital to South Florida.
I know that it gets a reputation that it helps this huge corporation. But in my district in Miami, where we have a huge airport, I see them helping just lots of small mom-and-pop shops.
In the deal to keep the government funded this fall, House Republicans agreed to extend the bank's charter for just another 9 months. That made Ross Leighton breathe a sigh of relief.
There are a lot of big players who are against it. The majority are for it. So we sort of, you know, split the baby in half and let's see what finally happens in the end.
Democrats, like South Florida's Frederica Wilson, wanted a longer-term extension of the bank. She says GOP leaders are afraid to stand up to rank-and-file Republicans.
I think that this was all that they could muster at this time, but when we come back, we'll be ready for a fight to expand it because it doesn't make any sense. It's something that businesses need. It's something that has been in place for generations. So what's the point in trying to deny that?
Extending the bank for just another 9 months buys the new Congress that takes over Washington in January time to either reform or pull the plug on the bank. Diaz-Balart is hoping in that time his Republican colleagues will reconsider their opposition. Otherwise, he fears for businesses in his district.
To me, the problem with eliminating altogether is that you're in essence unilaterally disarming, because other countries do actually subsidize their products. And we're not talking about doing that. We're talking about at least giving the opportunity for American companies to give the purchases, those who are going to buy American products, in essence, to have a credit when it's not available. So I think the concept is a good one, particularly when it's not like we can stop doing it and the rest of the world will not.
Congressman Garcia says the Tea Party wing of the GOP is pulling the party too far to the right. He fears many want to eliminate the role of government in people's lives and businesses altogether, which is evidenced in the fight over the bank's charter.
What you have is an irresponsibility on the part of Republicans to engage in governing.
The little-known Export-Import Bank is now being debated in campaigns across the nation, which means its future may very well hinge on the outcome of November's elections. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Sunshine Economy reached out to Florida political opponents of continuing the Export-Import Bank. They did not return emails, or they directed us to previous comments they have made in the media. Republican Senator Marco Rubio has made a few statements about his opposition to the Export-Import Bank continuing. Senator Rubio told Fortune magazine, quote, "A better way to help American companies compete against competitors abroad is to remove all series and myriad of obstacles they face in America, whether it's union rules in some states or massive amounts of regulations imposed on them, one of the most expensive combined corporate tax rates on the planet," end quote. Rubio turns the debate over government assistance to U.S. exporters into a domestic economic policy discussion. He also sees an opportunity for the broader effort to define the Republican Party through the opposition to the Export-Import Bank. Here's Senator Rubio back in June on CNBC.
I think too often there have been instances where the Republican Party has allowed itself to be pictured as the party of big business, as opposed to the party of innovation and free enterprise.
You think we should not do the XM too?
Bank? I agree. Yeah, I do. I think the time for that program has come and gone.
Well, this debate is now and one that will flare up from time to time as the temporary extension on the bank expires next June. So let's go back to the beginning of the modern international trade and government guarantees. America was in the depths of the Great Depression, and a new president had just been elected.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear.
When President Roosevelt was sworn in for his first presidential term, he urged Congress and the country to act fast to stop the economic freefall. The new president pledged coordinated central economic action to boost America's economy, recognizing the global markets had ground to a halt, limiting U.S. exports.
The means of exchange are frozen in the currents of trade. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no market for their produce, and the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone.
That was the environment which led to the creation of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. The first bank was organized in 1934 to encourage trade, primarily with the Soviet Union. A second bank was started a year later to finance trade with Cuba. The two were eventually combined and expanded their financing to the world. Since those early days, it has continued to focus on Latin America. Still to come on our program, a quartet of modern exporters from Miami to Malaysia to Monaco.
It's not that easy to get financing from U.S. banks if most of your receivables are offshore.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. Trade wins the export business in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Shaving cream, polyester, surgical sutures, Canary Island date palm trees, all made in South Florida and sent across the globe. These are just three of the thousands of products manufactured or grown here that make their way to Miami International Airport or one of the ports en route to foreign markets.
One of our trademarks is Ombre.
That's Patricia Blasser. She's president of Collection 2000. It makes Ombre-branded men's products like shaving cream, deodorant, and talcum powder.
And we have that product registered or that trademark registered in the United States and many other countries.
That's because Blasser and her company sell Ombre men's products and its Collection 2000 women's products in 30 countries. The company is among the countless South Florida firms with small nameplates on their front doors, lined up inside faceless business and industrial parks with blocks and blocks of buildings housing a chunk of South Florida's exporters. Blasser's Beauty Supply Company is under a flight path for Miami International Airport, tucked in near the Palmetto and Dolphin Expressways interchange. Her conference room usually is reserved for meetings, but on the morning we met, the long table was taken over by soap and lotion samples for a new client.
Yo, Walter Mercado, me enorgullezco en presentar mi línea exclusiva.
Collection 2000 is making some of the new product line for the famed Puerto Rican astrologer Walter Mercado. Two of Blasser's workers were packing gift bags for the launch party last week when we spoke.
Lots of noise going around today between the packaging of the new materials. You hear the airplanes going over us as they come in to land at MIA. We're just west of some of the runways. And, of course, the trucks. This has to be the sound of success for you.
Yes, definitely. We like to be, this is the way we like to be, is busy and more work than we can handle. And that allows us to hire more people and to, you know, continue growing as a company.
That was a familiar refrain among the quartet of exporters we spoke with. Guarded optimism and a growing business from medical supplies to marine supplies, talcum powder to date palm trees. In the global industry of exporting, these are small companies, a few to a few dozen employees with annual sales in the seven or low eight figures per year. Traditionally, when they go overseas, they would have to have customers pay for at least a portion of their order up front, and definitely it would be COD, cash on delivery. Think of it like Craigslist, the online classified ad service. There's a reason ads on Craigslist demand cash only. A Craigslist seller is not going to accept credit from someone they don't know. Now imagine you're not selling on Craigslist to someone in Pembroke Pines or Hialeah. At least they're subject to American laws. Imagine your buyer is someone in Quito or Cairo. How can you be sure they're going to pay you, especially if they don't pay up front for something they haven't received yet?
When we deal with overseas clients, and it doesn't matter what you see or hear, you really never know the truth financially, how financially stable they are.
That's Ian McDonald, who heads up Sea Vision, a Fort Lauderdale-based maker of underwater marine lights and lights for boats and yachts. He spoke to us from the Monaco Yacht Show in Europe. His business is overseas and finally growing after a rough few years.
Over the last 5 or 6 years, it didn't grow, it shrunk. It shrunk pretty rapidly, but we're seeing an encouraging signs now, both in the U.S., and in Monaco, at a boat show now, which is really a mega yacht show, we were quite concerned that the European economy, plus some of the problems worldwide in Russia and the Arab countries, would make this a very poor show this year. But in actual fact, people seem quite optimistic. So we're encouraged.
One of the tools both McDonald of Sea Vision and Patricia Blasser of Beauty Supply Maker Collection 2000 use is the Export-Import Bank of the United States. They use it to insure orders from foreign buyers. Now, the credit insurance is just that, insurance that the credit of a foreign buyer is good, that the U.S. exporter will get most of its money if the buyer goes bankrupt or war breaks out or political upheaval turns a foreign country less friendly to American business.
Prior to joining the bank, it's quite ironic. We obviously, during the freefall, the economic freefall, we had quite an outstanding balances with a lot of people, and many of them were never collected. Since we've been with the XIM Bank, we haven't had to call on them once.
Luis Arguello runs the Miami Lakes-based Demotec. Its 75 full-time employees make surgical sutures, blades, and staples in a factory that used to be owned by Johnson & Johnson. We reached Arguello via Skype while he was on a sales trip in Malaysia.
The small companies that are looking to export.
You can hear the Skype connection was not too good when we spoke to him. He told us small companies that are looking to export are required to sell on terms. He described it as very simple. If you don't sell on terms, you will never become a bit larger. You will never grow your employment base. What he is saying is that small exporters cannot demand cash on the barrel for products. They have to offer terms, such as 30 days or 60 days or 90 days for foreign customers to pay. In account speaking, those are accounts receivable. Those take cash on the part of the exporter to make product and ship it out without getting paid for a month or two or three, and credit on the part of the foreign buyer, who the exporter hopes will pay them at some point in the future. What Demotec, C-Vision, and Collection 2000 in South Florida do with their export-import credit insurance is to turn those to-be-paid bills into cash by using them to get short-term loans from a financial institution here in the U.S. Instead of waiting 30, 60, or 90 days for the foreign buyer to pay, they can take those invoices insured by the Export-Import Bank and use them as collateral. For that, the exporter pays a fee to the bank. At medical supply maker Demotec in Miami Lakes, about 54 cents of every dollar in sales is involved in this type of transaction. 85% of Patricia Blasser's beauty supplies made in Doral wind up in foreign markets.
It's not that easy to get financing from U.S. banks if most of your receivables are offshore.
Offshore is the smallest part of George Nottingham's nursery business right now. He began in 1986 with a borrowed pickup truck and now sells millions of dollars worth of palm trees planted and grown in American soil in Palm Beach County. He sells about $2 million worth of trees overseas now, mostly in the Caribbean. He's planning on growing that and growing it fast.
We have every reason to believe that we'll see revenue growth to the tune of 60-65%. So you're looking at growing your national sales from, call it, $1.8, maybe call it $2 million a year, growing that to three and a quarter.
That's $3.25 million a year. Nottingham spoke to us on his cell phone off the convention floor of a trade show in Orlando. Nottingham figures he could export upwards of $5 million worth of palm trees from Palm Beach County by 2016. He also relies on the Export-Import Bank to insure a few hundred thousand dollars worth of his international business. That translates into jobs. Three new managers will be hired for groundworks of Palm Beach County, and eight part-time jobs will become full-time.
Once we have all of the product complete to fulfill that order, then...
Back at Beauty Supply Maker Collection 2000, Patricia Blasser is talking us through the process of getting products from Doral overseas, a process she hopes politics in Washington doesn't disrupt in the debate over the future of the Export Bank.
For the packing slip and for the warehouse.
Still to come on our program, the four areas of criticism against using taxpayers to help exporters.
Do we take too much risk? Two, in terms of areas around governance. And three, are we crowding out the private sector? And maybe four, are we doing enough in small business?
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, Trade Winds, the export business in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. You can follow along and join the conversation on Twitter. At WLRN is our call sign. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Fred Hochberg lives in Miami Beach, but he works in Washington, D.C. He's a bureaucrat and, since 2009, a banker. Now, he started his professional career running his family business, a mail order company his mom started and was named after her, the Lillian Vernon Corporation. Over the next 9 months, it is his job to convince critics on Capitol Hill the Export-Import Bank of the United States should remain in operation. He's chairman and president of the bank. We spoke with him from Washington, D.C.
Exporters and companies are making plans, making your business plans out a year, 2 years. You're not doing it 3, 6, or 9 months at a time. So the most important thing is that businesses have certainty so they can make investments and to really fulfill long-term sales plans, and therefore add jobs, which is the key thing what we're all about.
But what do you need to do to answer the critics in Congress that have become very vocal about the Ex-Im Bank, despite it beginning back during the Great Depression in 1934?
Well, I think we're working with members of Congress. There are a number of ideas. Some of them still aren't as fully formed in terms of what kind of reforms some members of Congress are looking for. I think the debate has really shifted from whether we should have an Ex-Im Bank to what kind of reforms we need that are needed that Congress has concerns about. Now, these, I will tell you, the business community has not raised questions of reform. So the people who are using the bank to win sales and create jobs in America have not said you need reforms. Those reforms we've been making over time because we are responsive to customers. But there are some concerns about that, but not specific yet, around risk or around governance. And so I've been sitting down with members of Congress to see what kind of reforms they're looking for, what are their concerns, and how can we best respond to them.
If the criticism is not coming from your customers, why do you think it has gained some political momentum here in August and early September?
Well, I will tell you, the small businesses that I meet with, and I travel around the country, I spend a lot of time talking to small business owners, they're stunned. They're surprised. They don't really understand why an agency that generates jobs, supports their businesses at no cost to the taxpayer, and in fact sends money to the Treasury every year, is having this debate. That is somewhat stunning to them. But, you know, I guess as I've learned in this process, there are others that are focused on what's the role of government, where we fit in that. But I would say the small business owners, the companies I work with, they are quite surprised by this debate.
Yeah, maybe it is part of a broader debate that this country has been having politically for the past several years, thanks in no small part to the Great Recession. But the Great Depression is where the bank can trace its origins back to 1934. Clearly, global finance has evolved exponentially since then, Mr. Chairman. Is the bank still needed?
Well, we have the best financial markets in the entire world. We have the most resilient markets and the deepest markets. So the U.S. Export-Import Bank has a smaller footprint compared to our economy than probably any other export credit agency around the world. So we do a better job than almost anyone, but we don't do 100%. We finance, as you know, the estimates are about 2% of U.S. exports globally. But that varies a lot by product category and by country, where sometimes it's a far deeper engagement depending on certain products are hard to finance. Satellites are a great example of that are high-tech, support a lot of U.S. jobs and hard to finance. Small business, always hard to finance. So we have a very good market, but it's not a perfect market.
Do you think it's the actions by other federal agencies, especially the regulatory reaction that we've seen since the Great Recession in the financial industry, in part because of legislation coming out of Congress and going to the Department of Treasury and other financial agencies such as the Federal Reserve, that have created the environment that the Export-Import Bank still has a space in this 21st century economy, as you articulated?
Well, I think let's look at you mentioned the depression and the recession. You know, in the aftermath of this recession, the greatest drop in economic activity since the depression, our loan portfolio, our loans made, soared virtually well over 100%. So when banks retreat, we step in to fill in the gap. Of late, banks coming back into the marketplace, and we've been able to trim back again. So someone once said, just if you haven't had a fire in 5 years, it's not time to sell the fire truck and close the fire station.
Is there a place in the world that Export-Import Bank won't do business for various political or economic reasons?
Well, we don't do business in North Korea. We don't do business in Cuba, Venezuela, places like that, or places where the risk is simply too high because we want to make sure we're going to get paid back.
We're speaking with Fred Hochberg, the chairman of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. The great majority of your customers are small businesses. The great majority of the dollars that you extend
are directed to help what some consider big businesses. How do you try to level that playing field so that while small businesses may make up a minority of the money, big corporations, household names, General Electric, Boeing, others, make up the large dollar volume amount?
Well, very clearly. Let's begin. At the Export Import Bank of the United States, in terms of direct loans to small, directly working with small businesses, very close to 90% of the clients we work with are small companies, just as you stated. And this year it's running about 22-23% of the dollars. But when we look at the larger companies, which, as you said, get a majority of the funding, let's remember those large companies, and you know whether it's a GE or Boeing or others that you mentioned, they are brilliant, innovative engineering firms that largely outsource to the supply chain the manufacture of the goods, and then they assemble them. So even in the auto industry, we call them assembly plants more than manufacturing plants. So when you say the Boeing company, Boeing will tell you 60-80%, depending on the model, is through the supply chain. It's not happening in a Boeing factory. Mm-hmm. It's happening at small companies around this country.
So why is it those smaller companies in the supply chain don't have a relationship with the Ex-Im Bank? Is it because they're not exporters?
Well, many of them are not exporters, or many of them export because they're exporting through another company. We visited a company in Memphis called Ace Pumps, and they make the pumps that are found on a lot of Case New Holland farm equipment, the actual pumps that spread the fertilizer and the pesticides and so forth. And literally, they're a hidden export. I was there. The pumps are hidden under in the undercarriage of the farm equipment. So they don't directly export, but they ship those goods to Case New Holland, and Case New Holland then exports around the world. So many of them are only exporters through, because they're incorporated into a larger product.
I want to get back to kind of the reform debate that your agency is going to undergo in the next 9 months, obviously, as you move toward that June deadline. What types of reforms can you specifically point to today, Mr. Chairman, that the bank is ready for?
Well, first of all, let's just remember, since the last reauthorization, and at that time the Financial Services Committee was chaired by Spencer Baucus in the House and Tim Johnson in the Senate, we put in about a dozen reforms just 2 years ago around transparency, around textiles, around risk, around default rates. So we've put in a number of reforms just recently. And we've done a number on our own. We've reformed how we look at things like Tide Aid. We've reformed how we look at content for small businesses. The things that we're exploring now, we really want to work closely with Congress because I want to respond to their concerns. I don't want to just come out with a bunch of ideas that don't respond. I want solutions to their problems. You know, I've been in business for 20 years. There are a lot of business people who have solutions in search of a problem. I want to answer what their concerns are. So they generally have come in three areas or so. One is a risk. Do we take too much risk? Two, in terms of areas around governance. And three, are we crowding out the private sector? And maybe four, are we doing enough in small business? So risk, we report our defaults to Congress every 90 days. We have an outside audit firm. We have gotten a clean financial bill of health, an unqualified opinion for 25 years in a row. So, but if there are other concerns around risk, I want to address those.
We know that there have been fraud allegations made against four former officials, questionable contracting practices, allegations of kickbacks from companies, foreign companies wanting to do business in the United States via Ex-Im financing. What can you do to assure Congress and assure taxpayers that the governance allegations that have been made here will be addressed?
Well, let's begin with, we have, and I have, zero tolerance for that at the Export-Import Bank. And I'm actually very proud of the culture we have at the bank. In each of these instances, and they're the only time in my over 5 years of the bank that we've had anything like this. So one, each of these cases were essentially referred to our ethics officer and the inspector general because other employees saw something that looked suspicious, that didn't look right. So we have a culture that says something's wrong here. I need to bring this to someone's attention. You know, we have a police department for a reason. We have laws, we have values, but not everybody obeys them. And on the one you mentioned there of kickbacks, that case goes back to 2002, 4, 5, and 6, you know, before we had an inspector general, before a lot of those reforms were put into place.
Is it your sense
and
that...
Way before I ever got... I didn't get to the banks in 2009.
2009, right. Is it your sense that the critics are digging up zombie cases?
Well, I think that we have, let me say, the best example of what is our practice is the fact that our default rates, our claims, are less than 0.1%. The fact that we've gotten a clean audit for 25 years in a row from an outside, independent, public certified accounting firm. We would not have that if we were running a very leaky ship. So the fact is, there is good governance, and this extends even way before I got to the bank. We have a staff of people who are focused. The fact that we have the full faith and credit of the United States government is something nobody at the bank takes lightly. People know that that's the trust that the taxpayers of our country have put into us to support jobs and protect the taxpayer.
That's Fred Hochberg, chairman and president of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. Still to come on our program, Tradewinds, the export business in South Florida. What's changing and challenging for exporters here?
There was probably a time in South Florida, and to some extent some people still operate this way, where you could say, you know, this is the business I'm in. I'm going to ship computers to my uncle or my cousin back in Bogota, and that's going to be my business. You know, that's what I'm going to do. But increasingly, that gets harder and harder.
And we're back on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Exports are not king in the trade kingdom that is South Florida. We have a unique distinction among American trade points as one in which imports more than we export. You've heard of the trade deficit. For more than a generation, America has bought more from foreigners than we have shipped to them. That's the trade deficit, but not here in Miami. Ken Roberts is the president and CEO of World City, a media company based in Coral Gables that concentrates on global trade data. He's been watching South Florida trade for more than 15 years.
Right now, trade in South Florida is soft, and in part that is not really because there's less stuff moving through Miami's airports and seaports, South Florida's airports and seaports, but because some of the things that are moving are changing. And one of the big ones is gold. The value of gold went up phenomenally for a number of years as the global economy was difficult. It is now coming back to earth. People are less interested in gold a little bit. And so that import and export figure for South Florida is declining. Intel has basically shuttered its microprocessor plant in Costa Rica. Those chips used to come through Miami. That is decreasing. It has nothing to do with Miami, what it did here or anything, but that's the truth. In terms of flowers and T-shirts and medical devices and heavy equipment, all those things are still moving in and out of South Florida's airports and seaports.
What is it telling you about the trade partners, the demand for U.S. products to get overseas or for Asian products or European products that are coming through South Florida?
Sure. Well, so if you look at South Florida's top trade partners, they tend to be Latin American countries. They tend to be Brazil, Venezuela, Colombia, Peru, Dominican Republic, Honduras. We tend to be sort of the shopping cart for Latin America, we like to say. So Miami tends to have a trade surplus, tends to have a very large trade surplus. In the last 20 years, it's the only customs district in the country of about four dozen that has had a trade surplus year in, year out. Almost every year in those 20 years, it has set the record for the largest U.S. trade surplus in history. This year, 2014, South Florida will not finish as the number one trade surplus. Seattle will. South Florida's trade surplus is diminishing, and largely that's because of increased imports from China in particular, but Asia in general.
What's that telling you about those businesses that are primarily in that transactional business between exports and imports and in terms of their ability to operate in a growing, globally competitive environment?
I think, you know, what's true in sort of all aspects of business is true in the trade community. You have to be on your toes. You have to be willing to look for new opportunities. There was probably a time in South Florida, and to some extent some people still operate this way, where you could say, you know, this is the business I'm in. I'm going to ship computers to my uncle or my cousin back in Bogota, and that's going to be my business. You know, that's what I'm going to do. But increasingly, that gets harder and harder. Latin America has had relative stability for a decade, which is sort of unprecedented for the region. There's obviously exceptions, but if you look at the region as a whole, it's been a pretty solid run for a decade or so, and that's good for the Miami export market.
What do you see as the challenges as the competition has stepped up that they're facing?
I think the challenge for anybody to do it at first is just where do you start? And I think a number of smaller companies sort of get, I don't want to say dragged into it, but they get an inquiry from offshore and some, I want your product or your service, and they have to figure out how to do it. And what does it mean? And who do you talk to? And how do you, can I go to a bank? And will they give me financing? And what paperwork do I have to fill out? And what is a freight forwarder? And et cetera, et cetera. Miami is home to an enormous number of these smaller exporters who have a cousin somewhere in the region who says, I need some computers. And you sort of it begins as an informal thing, and then his friends need them, and before you know it, you got a little business going.
Where are the opportunities for South Florida companies looking to do partnerships and business overseas?
That's a good question. I would say there's always going to be, everything can change tomorrow. But
Why is that? What do you mean? Political instability specifically? Or
It could be political instability. It could be economic. It could be an invention. I mean, things can change. I mean, so one of the slight trends you see going on is that computer sales are tougher now than they were because why? People started going to laptops. Then they started going from laptops to tablets. And now we got these magical little devices in our pockets called the cell phone that literally do perhaps more than a computer does and are just that much more powerful. So those kind of changes can drastically change things completely. So look at Microsoft. At one point, Microsoft was shipping those CDs all over in big books and big packages all over the world, presumably, right? I mean, nobody does that anymore. It's now online. So things can change rapidly. Things can change slowly. The gold situation that I talked about earlier, that was just a reaction to the economy. That'll come and go. But along with trends like that, so suddenly gold becomes very valuable. So what happens? Well, in Colombia and Mexico, they decide they got to get every bit of gold out of the ground they possibly can. What do they need to get the gold out of the ground? Well, they need big, heavy machinery. So where's that machinery going to come from? Well, a lot of it can come through South Florida. So Caterpillar and Deere and Komatsu and those companies have all sorts of heavy equipment. Those sales go up. So, it works its way through the system, and there's many, many impacts and many, many changes that can occur at any given time.
As somebody who's watched this data and watched this industry for a number of years and have seen the concentration in the industry as well as the explosion of the data as Miami right. and South Florida has matured, where does it tell you the business is going here and what this community needs to do beyond the infrastructure to be able to continue to take advantage of the opportunities of the geography?
Right. The one of the real risks for anybody who's successful, and Miami's been very successful, becoming sort of the gateway to Latin America, the capital of Latin America, et cetera, is there's all sorts of people gunning for that. The place that looks the most like Miami in terms of its trade with the world, if you strip out oil and chemicals, is Houston. So if you look at who some of their top trade partners are, they start looking a lot like Miami because they got Brazil and they got Argentina and they got Chile and they got Colombia in their top countries. And there's just always the risk. Atlanta has for a long time wanted some of this business that we have here. Panama City wants it. Sao Paulo on another level wants it. Mexico City on it. So everybody's sort of gunning for what Miami has. Miami has done a remarkable job for a relatively small place at becoming a relatively important place. It's not that big a place when you look at Sao Paulo and Mexico City and so forth. But it's a city that is sort of disproportionately important relative to its size. And in large part, that is due to its amazingly entrepreneurial nature. You get all sorts of people showing up here with just the willingness to work hard and take a chance and go for it. And that has fueled Miami for a long time. And Miami certainly has to keep that because there's people who want to take what Miami has. And Miami should, South Florida should never think that we deserve this or own it or are entitled to it forever, because there's other people that will take it first chance they get.
Ken Roberts with World City. Now, what does the data look like? We'll have several graphs showing all the trade information and how it's changed over the past decade for South Florida on our website at WLRN.org. Look for Sunshine Economy. Still to come on our program, the evolution of exporting from South Florida.
We are the number two city in the United States for exporting wildlife. So, you know, we're sending horses and cattle to Latin America.
This is the Sunshine Economy, Tradewinds, the export business in South Florida. Thanks again for listening. In the past decade, while America's exports have grown, the value of goods leaving the U.S. from the Miami Custom District has grown substantially faster. Now, true, not all of those items departing from MIA, Port Miami, or Port Everglades are made here in South Florida, but the expanding business has brought more competition and more specialization. Mimi Whitefield is an international reporter for the Miami Herald.
During the early 1980s, everybody thought they could be an exporter. It was good enough to speak Spanish and know a few people in Venezuela or Bolivia. So there were all these small-scale exporters. Then came the economic crisis in Latin America, what's known as the Lost Decade. It got much harder to do business. A lot of the poorly capitalized exporters just fell out, or the pseudo-exporters went away to greener pastures. So it has to be a pretty sophisticated business these days to make money.
And what's driving that sophistication? Is it the continued developing of those markets? Is it competition to get into those, especially Latin American Caribbean markets, on the part of other exporters from Houston and Savannah and Atlanta?
Well, everybody is trying to eat our lunch these days, so it has become a lot more competitive.
They're still small companies, though. It's still concentrated, really, on these small single product or single category exporters.
Yes, they are. And in many ways, the exporters mirror the South Florida economy. So in the Midwest, where you have these multinationals, they tend to handle the trading. We don't have these large manufacturing agriculture companies here. So by and large, the trading is still being handled by a company that might have 7 or 8 employees. They might specialize in a particular market because that's where they have their best contacts. But they are growing up in the sense that we've seen a lot of variation. Some economies in Latin America are doing quite well right now. An economy like Venezuela is doing disastrously. So you don't want to really put all your eggs in one basket. You need perhaps to diversify a bit with your product mix. And really, you're going to have problems if you're only try to sell to one market.
And to some degree, increasingly, we're seeing these South American exporters reach out to European countries, diversify into the Middle East, especially the high-end kind of luxury goods, luxury service markets, and then begin to reach the other way, right? Reach west to try to get into China and Asia.
Well, we shouldn't just talk about exporters these days. What you're seeing increasingly in Miami is the importer-exporter. So you'll have a relatively small company that is sourcing, electronics products, machine parts, maybe even consumer goods in China or other Asian countries, and then exporting them down to Latin America and the Caribbean.
This is a quiet industry in that it doesn't make necessarily a lot of public noise locally, and to some degree it's in those industrial warehouses and those business districts, tucked in around Miami International or the ports in South Florida. These aren't on, big thoroughfares, and they don't raise the flag necessarily. And so I guess, do they get the respect as an industry like, tourism and logistics do?
Well, I think there's some, as you said, it's kind of a hidden industry. But there are some very unusual products that are being traded through Miami. And, as you drive down the Palmetto, for example, you'll go through something, you'll go through what's known as the tile district. Where did those tiles come from? They've come from Spain, Italy, Brazil, granite from Brazil. They're going all over the region, being exported again. We are the number two city in the United States for exporting wildlife. So, you know, we're sending horses and cattle to Latin America, handling zoo animals. There's kind of an interesting lobster connection to China that American Airlines has set up. They basically have a 40-hour window to get Keys lobsters to market in China, and they set up the logistics to be able to do that. Also, a lot of times these trading relationships can lead to investment, mm-hmm. and Miami has now become an important center for arbitration and mediation of cases in Latin America. So we're seeing, you know, sort of across the board evolution of international services in South Florida.
What do you think maybe the next catalyst or the next evolution is as you've watched the Miami export industry grow up over the past couple of decades? Where do you think it's headed?
Well, I think, you know, we're increasingly looking for new products. We want to become the center for example, a new effort is to kind of corner the Latin American perishable business. So that's a new initiative. We're obviously the flower import capital of the United States. So, you know, kind of carving out these specialties. And there is kind of a novel idea afloat now that Miami could somehow become a crossroads for Chinese trade with Latin America. Mm-hmm. There are people who say, or try to do this business now, saying, you know, instead of coming all the way from China to visit one of your customers in Latin America, why don't you come to Miami? Your customer will come to Miami. There are showrooms in Miami. You can do that business right here in Miami.
Mimi Whitefield with the Miami Herald. Miami may have nothing on Times Square as the crossroads of America, but perhaps for the 21st century. In the last decade, exports through the Miami Custom District more than doubled. $26 billion of goods and services left this area for the world just a decade ago. Last year, that had grown to $67 billion. We have more information on the website at WLRN.org. This is the Sunshine Economy. Trade Winds, the export business in South Florida. Because it cuts across geographic boundaries, it's about opportunities, but it's also about ideology in business. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Well, I pulled out of Pittsburgh, rolling down the eastern seaboard.
I got my diesel wound up and just running like I've never before. There's a speed zone ahead, all right. I don't see a cop in sight.
Six days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight.
I got 10 Ford gears and a Georgia overdrive.
I'm taking a little pills and my eyes are open wide.
I just passed the Jimmy and White.
I've been passing everything in sight.
Six days on the road.